ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What do Rasputin, Tupac, and Pharaoh Ramses III have in common? No, it's not the weirdest boy band ever. They all met their end at the hand of an assassin. From seizing power to silencing dissidents, Assassins unpacks the moments in which someone decides that murder is the move. Search for Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that when you go to the pub, diseases are one of the last things you think about. Although I guess it probably depends on the pub. But usually you're there for a drink or a meal or some friends and some good banter. But back in the 1850s, if you lived in a certain part of London, the only thing anyone was talking about was why so many people were just dropping dead.
What's happening is that cholera has broken out. They had to set up makeshift mortuaries because they couldn't cope with the amount of bodies. They'd run out of coffins, they'd run out of hearses, and everyone was just completely bewildered. No one knew what had hit them.
At the time, theories were flying around as to what caused this cholera outbreak, but nobody could quite crack the code until one doctor came along and looked at what was going on from a very different angle. Specifically, a very zoomed out angle.
He had a map of the streets of Soho, and he would mark on his map where people had died. And very, very quickly, this pattern emerged on the map.
And this pattern was the key to solving this deadly outbreak and would go on to form the foundations of epidemiology and disease mapping. I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of a doctor, a very important map, and how beer saved lives, and no one saw it coming. All right, so we are standing on a crowded cobblestone street in Soho, West End of London. It's the 1850s. What can I smell, Sandra?
Mainly excrement. The sanitation was virtually non-existent. Most people got their water from the pump wells in the street, into which sewage from the privies leaked. And when it rained hard, the raw sewage would come up through the basements.
Love the smell of fresh excrement in the morning. So this is the voice of Sandra Hempel. She is a science journalist and author.
But the crazy thing about it is, such was the state of London at the time, that it was considered to be not too bad at all. And nothing apparently compared with just down the road in Westminster. There was an area, infamous area, known as the Devil's Acre, which really says it all. And that apparently was far worse, although it's hard to imagine how much worse it could be.
So you've got raw sewage, you've got animal dung in the streets. Out of curiosity, how are people getting water and things like that?
Mainly in those areas, they were getting them from these pumped wells in the street. They were dotted all over the area and people would queue up with their buckets and use the water for drinking, for cooking and for washing.
Then, in 1854, a cholera outbreak grips the country. It's not the first one they've had in the UK, but this time it is incredibly fatal. People are dropping like flies.
Cholera was a relative newcomer to the UK at that time. I mean, the outbreaks were dotted across the country. And suddenly, overnight, whole families were carried off together or reduced to one sole survivor. And really, so tragically, some children went to bed with two parents and woke up in the morning to find they were orphans. And they were found wandering the streets, just lost. There were warning flags up all over the area, telling people to stay away. They had to set up makeshift mortuaries because they couldn't cope with the amount of bodies. They'd run out of coffins, they'd run out of hearses. Everyone was just completely bewildered. No one knew what had hit them.
Because the thing is, Londoners were not strangers to awful diseases, but cholera hit them in a particularly new and horrifying way.
it was regarded with so much fear and horror because there were other horrible diseases around, but people were kind of used to those. And one doctor said, oh, well, you know, we were familiar with them. We just regarded them as part of life, really. Things like typhoid and typhus, smallpox, tuberculosis. That was what they were used to, but it was mysterious, it was foreign, it was seen as a foreign invader, it was exotic, and it not only had these terrible symptoms, but it just behaved in this bizarre way, jumping around and hitting masses of people overnight, which none of the other diseases did.
What kind of death was it, if you were taken by this cholera at this time?
Well, it was dreadful, absolutely dreadful. The symptoms come on very, very rapidly, really with no warning at all. It starts with absolutely violent vomiting and diarrhea. And the diarrhea goes on until there's nothing left to expel, but the stomach carries on trying. And so you get what's called rice water evacuations, which is basically water with little bits of cells from your stomach lining in them. And after that, the skin turns dark blue or black. The blood becomes very thick, almost like tar, which led some people to think it might be a disease of the blood. And then there are these excruciating cramps where, I mean, people are shouting in agony, and sometimes the whole body is arched with cramp. It's absolutely dreadful.
So people are dying fast. In about a month, over 600 die in Soho alone. And no one can stop it because they don't know what's causing it. But there are ideas floating around as to what exactly is going on.
Well, there were lots of very weird and wonderful theories. One was that there was some kind of chemical, electrical disturbance going on underground. And somehow this was coming archly from down in the earth and affecting people. That was one idea. It was a particular sort of subset idea that it was all caused by the new railways. There were also ideas about how it might be something to do with people's lifestyles, such as drinking too much, or just their bodies. They might have too much carbon in their body, for example. And so when this air disturbance or electrical disturbance was around and about, you were particularly susceptible to cholera if you had something else going on.
But there was one main idea, and that was the theory of miasma.
Going back to Hippocrates, you know, in ancient Greece, people thought that the smell itself contained the disease, such as bad food, such as excrement. Hence, you have these stories of Cardinal Wolsey in Tudor times going around with an orange stuffed to his nose with lots of herbs in it when he went through a poor district, warding off illnesses. The problem with miasma, really, was that there was so much circumstantial evidence to support it, because there is indeed a link between dirt and disease. It's just without the germ theory, they were missing part of the puzzle. So they thought that the smell itself was the danger rather than any germs that were contained in this rotting matter.
And then in walks a gentleman by the name of John Snow. So introduce me to John Snow. Who is he?
John Snow is a doctor, a physician. He was born in York, 1813, into a very poor, humble, religious family, very upright, very respectable family, very hardworking. We don't quite know where the money came from to pay for his medical education, but it seems fairly certain that he had this wealthy uncle down in Bristol, who was a bookseller. And it seems fairly sure that the uncle actually paid for him to become apprenticed to a surgeon, which was how most doctors qualified. He was quite small in stature, very slight and thin. People said he was, sadly to say this, but he was slightly unremarkable. I mean, you wouldn't have looked at him in the street and said, oh, who's that? You know, he appeared to have no presence, as they say, very shy, a workaholic and not the sort of person who seemed on the face of it that he was going to set the world alight.
Okay, so he's a quiet man, dedicated to his work, and in a very 21st century twist, he's a vegetarian.
Which was very, very weird in those days. I mean, that marked you out as an absolute crank. and he also was a teetotaler. That, for a doctor, was astounding because vast majority of the medical profession believed that alcohol in small doses was actually very good for you. And most of them prescribed it for practically any disease, you name it, and the doctor was quite likely to prescribe, along with other things, a glass of brandy a day or a glass of wine a day. But John Snow would have none of that. So that again marked him out as being a maverick.
And he did some unorthodox things professionally too, didn't he? Like he was one of the pioneers of using chloroform during childbirth, right?
He was, yes, he was. And he took that up long before most of the medical profession did. I mean, there was a big debate going on as to whether it was acceptable to use anaesthesia in childbirth, because people said, well, you're going against the wishes of God if you try to relieve women of the pain of childbirth. He didn't believe that at all. And yes, he did. He made quite a good career for himself, actually, as it turned out. And at one point, he was asked to go to Buckingham Palace when Queen Victoria was in labour, and actually managed to have a chat with Prince Albert.
Right, so we have this sort of loner on the outside of the medical establishment, but he is a bit of a pioneer. He thinks outside the box. And all around him in Soho, people are dying in excruciating ways. There is this dominant theory that it's either in the air or in the electricity. But he starts to investigate it, doesn't he?
Actually, the starting point goes back to his apprenticeship days as a 19-year-old young man. He was sent off to look after the miners and their families in a pit village because there'd been a small outbreak of cholera in this pit village. And he was sent off by himself to try to look after them. He saw cholera close up for the first time, and he started thinking about it and how it behaved, and he continued to think about it long after he qualified as a doctor, long after he'd come down to London. He was continuing to think about it, and he thought two things. One, he thought that it must be a disease of the gut, because the symptoms always started with the digestive system. That was a starting point. He thought if it's been affecting the gut first, then it presumably was being passed on by mouth. If you ate infected food, it went down to your stomach and away you went. But then he thought about how the miners down the pit lived in these very insanitary conditions. Obviously, there were no privies or lavatories or anything down there. They would also bring their food down there and eat down there. So he thought about what they might be getting on their hands that they were then putting into their mouths with their food. But then he thought something else. He thought about the way that it behaved, the way the disease leapt around, struck all these people down in, you know, overnight in one go. And he thought, there's another way that this infected matter could get into people's systems, and that is if it got into the drinking water. That would explain everything. So he rushed to Soho and he went around knocking on people's doors and saying, how many people have died here from cholera?
It's an amazing thing when you think about it, right? Because a relatively middle-class doctor who's going door-to-door in some of the poorest parts of London with families who have just lost family members, and he just starts effectively, you know, doing what we would now call contact tracing, right?
Yeah.
He's going door-to-door and investigating. And I think, like, it's amazing when you think about where he's at culturally and what's going on.
Yes, it is. It is amazing. But he could talk to and mix with anybody, really. He was that kind of person. And there are lots of stories about when he was, you know, becoming known with his anaesthesia, of him helping colleagues who had a problem with a poor family sort of living way out of London. And after the end of a day's work, he would just go down to visit this family for no fee whatsoever. I mean, all pro bono. So he was perfectly happy doing things like that and did them all the time. It was also very extraordinary in medical terms.
So it is September 1854. We're about a month after the deadly cholera outbreak hit Soho, London. And John Snow is out, he's door knocking, he's taking notes on who's died and where they lived. And he marks it all down on a map.
And very, very quickly, this pattern emerged on the map. There was a small cluster of houses with massive number of lines against them. They looked like big black blocks on the street. And as you radiated outwards from this cluster, so the deaths became fewer and fewer until eventually they petered out. But what was blindingly obvious, right at the centre of the cluster, was the Broad Street pump.
I've got this map in front of me now and I'm looking at it, and it is an incredible thing because it is very obvious that there is a direct cluster around this street, Broad Street. But what I think is probably most intriguing for me about this, apart from the fact that he's done this incredible thing, is that there is a twist in this map, because even though it's geographical and you can draw some conclusions for that, there are people living within this cluster space who you think should be getting sick, but they are not. So who's the demographic who somehow is avoiding this illness?
There was a brewery just next to the Broad Street pump called the Lion Brewery. And there are more than 70 workmen employed there. And none of them died of cholera. And they couldn't work out why not.
And so John starts to investigate. And his journals tell us exactly how he did it.
He says, "I called upon Mr. Higgins, the proprietor, who informed me there were above 70 workmen employed in the brewery and none of them had suffered from cholera, at least in a severe form, only two having been indisposed, and that not seriously. The men are allowed a certain quantity of malt liquor, and Mr. Higgins believes they do not drink water at all, and he's quite certain that they never obtain water from the pump in the street. So, beer saves their lives, actually."
Right. So they're drinking beer instead of drinking water.
That's right.
Generally considered to be not the healthiest choice. But in this case, where the water is coming from is a particular pump, and that pump is the culprit.
Indeed. So that was the answer to that one. Obviously, something must kill off any cholera bacteria in the water that's used in the brewing process. You're not any better off if you drink spirits, if you drink gin or brandy, because there are lots of cases of people drinking gin or brandy or whiskey with a splash of water and dying very soon afterwards. So it's nothing to do with the alcohol, actual alcohol, presumably. It's the process.
It's just the absence of water this one particular pump.
It is.
So John Snow has cracked the case, and he's done it by observing patterns made on his map of who died of cholera and where they lived. And he's realised that the men who worked at the brewery in Broad Street, which was near the pump, they didn't die of cholera because they drank beer instead of water. Please do not try this at home. So he's backed up this theory, but then he has this very difficult task of actually convincing people that he was right.
It was just too revolutionary to say that a disease is waterborne. No one believed him.
See, this I find fascinating, right? So he's got a map and he's got actually quite a lot of evidence when you think about it, geographical, anecdotal. You've got a clear group of people or two that have not gotten sick and they are people that don't drink from the well. You've got other people that didn't have access to it and therefore they are also getting by. So he's got quite a lot of evidence. Why is it so hard to convince people that there's something in the water?
I mean, we see this today as well, I think. Because this idea of my asthma had been around for such a long time, people had forgotten that it was still only a theory. It was not proven fact. But when he finally got a few people to take notice of him, they just went out of their way to find ways out of his arguments and try to manipulate the miasma theory to somehow accommodate a little bit of what he was saying, but still wedded to miasmatism.
That little discovery within a bigger discovery, that the brewery workers were not affected, how important do you think that was in terms of him being able to triangulate a broader solution?
I think that was very important, actually. I really do, because he was looking at all of these smaller anomalies, smaller examples, but that was one of the really big ones. That was the big one, really.
What about the pump itself? Did he ever convince anybody that the pump was dangerous?
Not at the time. I mean, that in itself is a story within a story. When I first came across this and I started looking into it, I thought he'd persuaded the authorities to take the handle off the pump, which he did, and that overnight the death toll plummeted and Snow was proved right and he was the hero of the hour. That didn't happen. He did persuade the authorities to take the handle off the pump, although one of the members of the committee said afterwards, none of us believed Snow was right. None of us believed him, but we were just desperate and no one else come up with a better idea. So we thought, oh, well, why not? We've got nothing to lose. But unfortunately, the death toll had already started to come down of its own accord. So it really proved nothing.
In 1858, John Snow died at the age of 45, not from cholera, but from a stroke.
And he died without ever anybody acknowledging him or saying that he was right, except I think he would have been much more interested in how many lives could be saved rather than about getting any kind of kudos for himself.
But then, from the 1860s, germ theory, it started to take hold. Snow was inspired by this theory, even though it was an unproven opinion in medical circles, and he was definitely in the minority in subscribing to it.
Even so, a lot of people remained unconvinced. A lot of people were so set in this mindset that they still continued to hang on to the fresh air, the clean air, and the miasmatism. And it just went on for a couple of decades, really, I guess. There was no great epiphany, no great, oh, yes, gosh, look, this has happened, Snow's right. It was simply the evidence just piled up and piled up and piled up. And in the end, only a few complete fanatics were able to deny it. And so he did actually get recognised, his ideas were accepted, but it took a very long time for that to happen.
John Snow's work laid the groundwork for modern public health infrastructure, clean drinking water, proper sewage systems to prevent the spread of infectious diseases. And for Sandra, the big takeaway from this story was John's dogged pursuit of the truth.
And he went on no matter where it took him, no matter how much ridicule and contempt was poured down on his head. And he just didn't actually care what people thought of him. All the ridicule and insults, actually, from the medical profession he was exposed to just bounced off him. You know, he was this very quiet, very humble-seeming man, but he had such a powerful strength of character, such courage, really. And that's what I think we take for that. And absolute refusal to be browbeaten. And to be steered away from the path. There was no compromise. He wouldn't say, oh, well, maybe, you know, the miasmatists are a little bit right, but, you know, I've got my theory. Maybe we could come together and agree something. Absolutely not.
Sandra, thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, it was absolute pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. I really enjoyed it.
Sandra Hempel is a journalist and author of The Strange Case of the Broad Street Pump, John Snow and the Mystery of Cholera. This episode was produced by Rebecca Metcalf, Zoe Ferguson and Taryn Priadko on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. The sound design was by Angie Grant. And I would love to say a very big thank you to Asif. So Asif some time ago wrote in and asked us to look into this story. He was particularly curious about the connection between cholera and beer, which is how we got there. Now, if you, like us, if you've got a surprising moment from history that you would like us to investigate and find somebody brilliant, like Sandra, to explain it all you need to do is email us. You know the deal. No one saw it coming at abc.net.au. And of course, you enjoyed the story, share it with somebody who you think might like it, and make sure you find and follow No One Saw It Coming on wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Fennell, and I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.